What I wanted to start with is first, recapturing the post-strike chronology, because before the involvement in the SWP and leading the SP, and before the WPA organizing, there were factional fights beginning to grow within the UAW in 37.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be important to get some of that down and then move into the political developments up to 38, to the point that you left the Social Party, then begin the WPA organizing,
mm-hmm,
because at that point that was entrenched with the SWP.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So beginning with this post-strike chronology, what my concern was by shortly after the strike, within a couple of months, there's already beginning to be this actual fight. If you can explain the fight and what Kermit's role was in the union after the strike, and what your role was. And then if you can describe the factional fight a little bit, because by June of 39, there's already Martin's factions trying to pull a strike at GM,
mm-hmm,
which wasn't successful. And then that letter from Traeger to High Fish was in July, and that's about the point that you talked about that Kermit began to mobilize the forces in the fight against Martin. So if you can briefly describe that period in there in 37, within the UAW, following the strike.
Let's see, that would be after the strike was won, the General Motors strike was won in February. Even during the strike, you know, Martin had to be held in control because he issued the statements that we considered were irresponsible, they were done unilaterally, and without consultation either of the ranks or of the elected members of the executive board. And after the strike, in the summer months, after the strike, I don't remember, recall exactly when, but I went on the tour. Do you remember I told you these eastern states, and I spoke before a number of unions, and it was quite an extensive tour, and it embraced the period around May 1st because of Labor Day, the original Labor Day in this country, May 1st. And there in Rayburn Plaza was the first time I had ever seen such a huge gathering. And I addressed from the Rayburn Plaza in Philadelphia the marching parades there until I had gotten to New York and saw the hugest one of all, the largest one of all. And that was of great significance to me because I had never conceived the radical movement of America being so great numerically. I had always met with the small groups in Detroit and in Flint and having representatives from Charlotte, Michigan, and perhaps knowing about groups in Chicago and Wisconsin and places in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that came out of New York was sort of a faraway territory, and I thought about them being influential, much more influential. They usually set policies for all the radical parties. But numerically, I never saw so many bodies marching under the red flag of the Socialist Party contingent, the Communist Party contingent, all of the labor unions of that, the powerful garment workers of that whole area, all of the labor unions. And it started about 10 o'clock in the morning, and of course it was dark before the great huge 10 or 12 abreast masses of people filed past the Union Square podium. Do you want this information?
Yeah, I think it probably had quite an effect on you in terms of your political
decision. Oh, it did, it did. And I was then taken to speak up to the podium in the name representative of the Socialist Party of America. And I was supposed to be doing the speaking when the Socialist Party contingent came up. And here again, this was such a huge contingent and far beyond my wildest dreams, you know, that for a few moments when I got up there and viewed this great big, huge contingent with, I don't know, two or three rows of the red flag and then the Socialist Party of America banners, I couldn't get my breath for just a moment as I was... I was truly, truly, deeply impressed. So then I spoke for the Socialist Party of America, and I don't remember what other official spokesman of the party spoke after me, because this was quite a long period of time that the Socialist Party files passed. And then, of course,
did you speak about the strike and the Women's Emergency Brigade, or did you, was there more general speech?
No, I was brought there to speak as the Socialist representative telling about this great General Motors strike. And I'm sure that I said something about the women, because I felt so deeply impressed then also with my own experiences with women. And I'm sure that I made reference to it. However, I think that probably it was a little more general, in the sense that General Motors was a recognized big ogre worldwide. And it probably was a little more general in relation to bringing this huge corporation down to the bargaining table to talk with workers. But I'm sure that I brought references in about the women. But I did not speak to that. At that point, I was very impressed with the whole total picture of organized labor, too. And I felt that women had played a very, very important role in this one particular strike. But in my speeches, I do remember always reporting about the women, and especially guarding the gate of Plant 4, because when I spoke before a very, very large packed church, and if anybody could remember the name of A.J. Musty's Fellowship of Reconciliation building in New York, it was like a huge auditorium, not like a regular church as you would conceive of it, but a huge auditorium, and it was packed. And when I was talking about the women guarding the gate, I remember telling them about the 75 flat feet that came marching down, and the audience in New York didn't know what that term flat foot meant, and it was a common term in Michigan for a cop, a flat foot. So I remember, and I gave primarily the same speech wherever I went before, all of them, shipbuilding workers and all of them. And they held banquets, and I was made honorary members and given pins and so on, and their unions.
Did
the
red
hand
during your speeches,
Rachel? I don't recall whether I did or not. I do know that I showed them. I had the armband on, and I don't know if I went in with the tam on and spoke in that. I do know that they saw them, our emblems. But beyond that, one can't remember the words of the speech. So After I returned from this speaking tour, we came back in, and we had the auxiliary going, the women's auxiliary of Local 156 going. And they had put out a little bulletin, some kind of a mimeographed, a four-page bulletin or something, attempting to keep the women together. And the president of that was Tekla Roy, who was a member of the Socialist Party, and a very wonderful woman, very tall and very commanding type of woman, personable. And I was the vice president, because she did not feel sure of herself, and she felt when I came back that the two of us working together would be able to build it up. And it was sometime during this period that the women in Detroit got the idea of a conference of all of the auxiliaries of the auto locals that had been organized during the 37 strike, to get them into a conference of women's auxiliaries, and to have an elected state set of officers. So they called the conference in Detroit, Michigan, without consulting us, the Flint people, who had the most militant, the best known, and the originators of the brigades that were formed later in the other cities, and certainly the women who had played the most vital role in the whole strike period, without consulting these women at all on any portions of the agenda, on any future activities or plans. We were not even scheduled on the resolutions committee, nor to be a speaker at the conference, none of our representatives. And when we got down there, we found also that many of the locals that we had been in contact with, our women had been there, and they had been in Flint had not even been notified of the conference. And it didn't take us long from our past experiences to see that it was stacked with the locals that were controlled by the Communist Party.
Which cities were those again?
Primarily Detroit. Primarily Detroit. That's where they had, their strong forces. They didn't have strong units in small cities like Lansing. I don't know if they even had any members of the party there, or Pontiac, or any of the other. I think Indiana was, Ohio and Indiana, that area for the regional, it was a regional conference, not a state, was included, because when we got there, we also found that in order to count Cleveland in their ranks, Dorothy Krause was a delegate from Cleveland, Ohio, even though she was still in Flint, living in Flint, and had been working in Flint and hadn't been associated with the women's group there in Cleveland, the auxiliary. So we made the protest from the floor. I spoke and protested vigorously, and made the demand that nothing be done concretely or permanently, no permanent elections be held until the other women in the other areas could be represented and could participate on a democratic basis in setting up this regional conference of women's auxiliaries.
Do you recall how many women were there tonight?
I don't. It seemed as though we had, there was some kind of an arrangement where you had your delegates, which would be, I don't know, maybe 25 delegates, and I don't know exactly if it was on a proportional representation or not. I know from Flint, I was one of the delegates, I think there were two from Flint, with a whole contingent that went down with me. So we had an observer section also, and when Flint came in, we came in with a big group. As we usually did in those days, we had such a feeling of solidarity, and they had a contingent of people from Detroit also who were observers. And
the Flint Company with their banner and their cans.
Yes, and they had the banners, and Flint put its banner up in the front of the hall. I think each one was asked to put a banner up or some type of emblem that they had devised in their own women's auxiliaries. So ours was hanging up there, the big red and white banner of the Flint contingent was hanging in the front of the hall. And when we were just outvoted, outshouted, and not even given any consideration there in the conference, my women got very, very discouraged and disgusted, and we decided to walk out, but nothing could be accomplished there. If they were going to set up a dummy corporation without the participation of other women who were just as important, even though they weren't in the very center of Detroit, that we would walk out of the conference. This we did. And I remember a little short, fat, militant Polish woman by the name of Mary Wing, who walked up and yanked our banner off the wall and told them in no uncertain terms what a bunch of, I think she called them fascists, but it was a very strong term, meaning that they didn't at all believe in the democratic rights of women deciding their own future. So that fell through. Now, later on, under Homer Martin, or even perhaps at that time, I don't remember, Homer Martin appointed Eve Stone, who was a Lovestoneite, as the director of the Women's Auxiliaries in the International Union. But Eve Stone, of course, was left when the Lovestone and the Martinites split later on in the UAW in the factional fight. Eve Stone, I found to be a very intelligent woman and a very attractive and personable woman. I always was a little bit sorry I didn't get to know her better. After the factional fight began, I never saw her again, because I think that she might have been a woman that you could reason with. She was an intellectual, and she seemed to be a fairly objective person, at least in my conversations with her, while in my conversations with women who were under the aegis of the Communist Party. There was no reason with them. They had a line, they had orders that they were to carry out, and if you were going to stand in the way, you had to be brushed aside or knocked aside.
So the factional... By the time this conference is held in the summer, the factional fight had already increased in pitch within the UAW.
Oh, yes. Yes, and I think that it became apparent to everybody, even the Socialist Party elements who were never bitter factionalists in any situation, and who were primarily following Walter Reuther down there in Detroit, became apparent that Homer Martin, who was a former minister, who had a beautiful personality and was a great orator and could appeal and could speak like no other orator of UAW before or since, that he was an irresponsible and inexperienced man. And he felt that he had to live up to his image by disordering, issuing edicts without consultation. And in the process of drive by the Communist Party to dominate the union, the William Lovestone then had a group called the Communist Party Opposition, and they were more popularly known as the Lovestoneites, came in and offered to give Homer Martin advice because he hated to see the union taken over by the followers of the Stalinist Communist Party. And he, too, was an unscrupulous man, and he, too, was a man who didn't always... he made decisions that were expedient for the moment instead of making principled decisions or even attempting to get these decisions across to a group of people. He was a little arbitrary, too. He practically moved in with Homer Martin and became his political advisor. And mistakes were made on both sides, but certainly the collusion that began to appear at different locals with management and the Homer Martin group threw everybody, all of the progressive elements, the liberal elements, into the camp of Thomas, Addis, Luther, because there was no place else for us to go. We could not possibly have lined up with a man like Homer Martin. He was not adequate for the type of job that needed to be done at that time.
Well, what was Curtis' role in the local and on the executive board at this point?
Kermit was the chairman of the Chevrolet division of Local 156 up until the time that the local became separated into its component parts, according to the factories in Flint. They had met as divisions. They had division meetings of the Chevrolet workers, division meetings of the Buick workers, but they were called Buick Division of Local 156, so on. Kermit was the... chairman of the 156 Chevrolet Division, and John Lanesfield, another member of the Socialist Party, was elected as the secretary of the Chevrolet Division. He was the titular head of all of the, and spokesman for all of the Chevrolet workers there in Flint. He was a good speaker. He was immensely, I got a frog in my throat, immensely popular. Naturally, with everybody in Flint after the heroic culmination of the strike and the activities of the plant floor workers. And he was active in deciding on the total, then. The heads of these divisions comprised the executive committee, the executive board of Local 156. And he was probably the strongest leader as far as influence was concerned, and ideas also of the Local 156 at that time. When I was, let's see, when did the Kersley Park demonstration take place? Oh, dear God. I was out of town. I don't know whether, I think I was on the speaking tour at the time. He and Roy Reuther organized the largest labor demonstration the city of Flint, had ever, ever seen. And that filled a park that had just one contingent after another marching into it from all local unions in the city. That meant the transport workers, the J.C. Penney workers, the A.G. Redmond workers, and the Standard Cotton Products workers. Every little group, you know, the teachers attempted to organize, but they got clobbered the worst of all, and the industrial union movement couldn't do anything about that. Those teachers were blacklisted for life. They paid the highest penalty, I think, of any group that attempted to organize under the aegis of this local, great big local 156. So he was very, very influential. Roy Reuther was insolent, but I can't tell you when he left. Because here again, I was on the tour, I came back, I played a certain role at a particular juncture of other activities, and then I collapsed and was sent to the sanatorium in the Adirondack Mountains.
You weren't involved in when they were mobilizing the Progressive Caucus for the fight against Martin. You were out of Flint at that point.
I think in the beginning I was. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that I was. Although you must remember that these things were in their early formative stages, even at the right at the end of the strike.
Mm-hmm.
We knew then that it was during the strike. He was a handicap. He was a hazard that we had to face because we didn't know what statement he might issue to what group of employers. Can I turn this off for a moment? Kermit did become a leader then of the, what did we call the group that was in the anti-Martin forces? Was it the Thomas Addis group? I don't know. Unity Caucus, I think that was it, was the name of the Thomas Addis group. He became one of the leaders in Flint, of course, of that caucus. And Flint was quite a point of violence because we had, if you remember, I told you that the men who took the brunt of the Battle of Plant 9 were Lovestonites. And there was Tom Clancy and Melvin Center and Ted LaDuke and their little following. These are people who came out of the SP who were known and who had been in Flint for quite some time working in the plants. And their following was not big,
mm-hmm.
but they were respected for what they had, the role they had played in the strike also. And then there was the group from Fisher One who was opposed to the tactics of the CPers out there in Fisher One, and they organized around an unscrupulous character by the name of Bert Harris. He was a political opportunist, nothing more. And several other people whose faces I can see, but whose names I can't recall. So between Fisher One and Chevrolet, they produced, and of course they had other people in the Martin forces from Buick and AC, who felt that he was the more moderate and the more reasonable of the two groups, of the two caucuses. And Martin did have a personal following. So they did have the Martinites were quite strong in Flint. And we had pitched battles. They were actually in the streets. In one event, they had two separate halls. I mean, at one period, they had two separate halls across from Fisher Local Number 1. I mean, across from Fisher Plant Number 1. We had the Martin Local, 581, Martin Headquarters, and we had the UAW Thomas Addis Group headquarters. And again, they had professional people in the Martin forces. In fact, later on they found out that the Black Legionnaires had lined up with the Martin forces because naturally it appealed to all of the reactionaries who thought that unions were communist-led anyway and communist-inspired. So all the reactionaries lined up with him, and especially in the Fisher One situation. Well, in all parts of the city, the reactionaries lined up with him. And in this one battle that we had there, their forces, the Black Legionnaires and their professional people, again, these were the what we call the jiu-jitsu experts that would come out of a crowd and flip people on their backs and injure them badly, and they would disappear before you could see them. They cut the wires of the Fisher One Thomas Addis Group headquarters, and we were the legal group of the UAW in terms of strict legality, mm-hmm. because they held a rum convention at another date, and so we considered our headquarters mm-hmm. the legal headquarters, and they set theirs up afterward. They cut the telephone wires. And they were massing in front of this local. I was in there at the time, Clayton Carpenter was the first elected financial secretary of that local, I think. He was a pro-Turning Party member and a brilliant man. Was also with me, with the other officers and members of Fisher One. I only remember Clayton from, because we were just having a discussion at the time, and he became the leader, the one to give the instructions. He was the, I guess he was the officer that would be in command of the local, the financial secretary. Apparently the president and vice president weren't there. And as the crowd grew bigger and more menacing in front, and we did not know at that point that our wires had been cut, we decided to call for help and found out that the telephone wires had been cut. And that's when he ordered then that the doors be barricaded and that we take all of the chairs in the downstairs part of the hall and make a barricade from which we might be able to throw things or defend ourselves. Certainly we had no guns or anything like that. No, this was unexpected, but we always had people around the hall because of the confrontations and the attempts to take over our meetings in our halls. So I went upstairs to the second floor, and it had windows facing the street from the second floor, and we were very concerned because we saw the crowd was larger. We saw these men coming out and doing their violent acts in front of the police, and the police were not seeing anything that the Martinites did, but if our people, and the groups of our people came at that time, and there was a real confrontation, but we were outnumbered, and if any of our people did anything, they were immediately nabbed and arrested. And it became very apparent to us, this is a very unfair situation. And the police were standing there, ostensibly, to guard the hall. But they were standing there letting all of this this brutality go on. And there were some of us up on the hall, and we thought of the idea of there was some toilet lye in the toilet on the second floor. And there was a little cooking range for making coffee and so on, of taking a pail and boiling up some hot water with lye in it and dumping it out to get, get some of the people away from the door so that they wouldn't rush in and do whatever they were going to do. And they were in no happy mood. When you see a mob mood, it can mean death. You don't really, to talk about it now, you don't really appreciate that unless you're right in the middle of it. And there's no reasoning when mobs go into action on the basis of emotion alone. And so we boiled up this pail of hot lye water, and we dumped it out over the window. And I remember it hit one of the policemen right on his, right down his sleeve. He jumped out of the way, and there was a white streak going, I mean a lighter streak going down his jacket. And for the time being, it did deter anybody else because they didn't know how many pails of hot lye water we had up there. And apparently that situation became resolved when I guess the police knew they had to act a little more, less biased.
Would that have been in that summer period or up in front before you were hospitalized? Or would that be later than that?
Soon I'll have to look that up. I really will. And it would be so comfortable if any of those, Clayton Carpenter is not alive, if any of those people were alive that I could refer to.
Because there was a strike that the Martin forces told the GM in June of 37. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was June of 39 that they told that strike at GM. So would it have been that late already, that?
39. I must have been in the sanatorium somewhere in the fall, and it was winter and spring of 37, 38.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it was. Perhaps it was in 39 in June. Can't tell you.
Well, when you got out of the... during a lot of this time, when there was...
But this was an ongoing thing, you know? Where there were fights in every union meeting, every time you called a meeting, there were these caucuses that would be meeting to arrange their plans. and to take over the meeting either by eloquence or by clubs or whatever method. It was a life and death struggle because you had two political ideologies coming into conflict, plus the reactionaries who are always wanting back to the corporation, wanting the end of the union, and the union was very new. The union could have been destroyed at that stage.
So you were involved in this struggle.
Yes. Now here we didn't.
How were you viewed? I mean, I presume that since you weren't a member of the union at that point, then there probably were not very many other women involved in the national fight. Were you viewed primarily as Kermit's wife or someone who had been an active in the strike? Or?
No, I was widely known, and the press at that time also pointed me out as one of the, you know, one of the radicals. The press, again, was not sympathetic to our group in Flint. No, I was known on my own.
When the factionalism occurred within the UAW itself, within the local, what did they see your role as being during that struggle against the
law? I don't know. I was in those meetings, those union meetings, always sitting in the back of the hall. I was very interested in the whole development of the union. I had never seen anything so powerful and have such influence. And as a member of the Socialist Party and later of the SWP, I was always able to come and go in those union meetings without any question. And my interest was constant, where other wives thought, well, we've gained our economic demands and I'm getting an adequate amount to feed my family, care for my family. They did not come. Women very seldom went to union meetings.
That was the question, after the hospitalization, the WPA worked as it starts with 39 in that period of almost a year. What was the focus of your activity?
That's so probably it. Yes. And it was also helping to write leaflets. I was always involved in drawing up and writing leaflets for the Chevrolet division or, you know, whatever group of people would come and ask a little help us with this and draw it up. I was no professional at it. It's just that I got stuck with the job.
So there was that activity.
Yes, I did. And as an SPer, now remember the SP was active meeting every week. And as an SPer, I was intimately involved in every phase of it. I can't recall all of it, but I was intimately involved.
It just seemed to me to be the gap there, and I wasn't sure quite what happened in that period after the hospital.
No, I did a lot of leaflet writing in all periods, and sometimes they would even be submitted by many other men. But you must remember when we organized the UAW, it was from raw factory workers, and most of them hadn't even had a chance to graduate from high school, and they didn't know how to write letters. Women didn't write letters. And so anybody who could put anything down on paper and make it sound like an appeal or a winning argument was just drafted. So I did a lot of leaflet writing.
So you're being at the union office at the time of this confrontation with just representatives, in effect.
Yes.
Your ongoing involvement.
Yes.
In
daily involvement in it. Wherever there was, yes, and when it got to that point where Union Hall was threatened and I heard about it, I would usually be with another group of people. I mean, either alone or with groups of people. It was just a natural daily way of life for me.
So basically, because I had thought that after the strike, it seemed like there was a sudden decline in activity. But basically, there wasn't. But that with the fact that there was no more brigade, there was no more ongoing thing, there wasn't a defined role for you.
That's right.
But that you were involved in the day-to-day basis. Now, at this point, you know, up until, say, 38, when you left the Socialist Party, your relationship with Kermit was still all right at this point. You were working together and in more agreement, or was there beginning to be problems by that point?
Politically, we were always working together. He had a problem with alcohol, and this became more and more aggravated. And I know also, too, that my role and my recognition was not something that was easily acceptable for him. Because men would come up, for instance, when he went off WPA, oh, so your wife's supporting you. And this was very, very hard for him to take. And it was a period when it had been hard for most men to take. And when I would make a decision or write a leaflet or anything like that, very often they would come and ask my advice without thinking, you know, about talking to him. And these things apparently was a terrible assault to his ego. It was something that it was very hard for him to take, and it just broke a big one, big wedge. And I was of the determination that I wanted to save my marriage, but at the same time, I just couldn't say no and not participate and sit home and crochet a doily. I just wasn't made for it. And I was more or less, I was more of a political animal than he was within the political movement. And I did much more reading and following of the internal discussions in the political movement, in all of the parties.
That was the next thing I wanted to get into, was the whole, was the political development. Beginning, well, first when you and Carol Johnson Ingram formed the Socialist Party, were you aware in those very early formative years of the very early factions and the fight between the old guard and the progressive and the militants and the Revolutionary Policy Committee in the early 30s of the Socialist Party, or were you relatively unaware of those kinds of things?
I think we were, if we were aware of them, they didn't count too much at the time, because our primary job then was just to learn about socialism. And I read in one of the women in your book, having been introduced to socialist ideas through Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward. Backward, yes. And we read books like that, and we'd get them from the library, and we had classes in Fred Henderson's, The Case for Socialism. Fred Henderson wrote from England, and it was a little red book about the size of your book, and not even quite that large. And it was very, very readable. It was one of the, I wish I could get a copy of that book today. And we used to distribute that and discuss that book over and over with people, because it was so elementary, such an elementary description of well, it started out, nowhere in the beautiful Rocky Mountains and the nature, the wonders of this earth, can you find the name of Rockefeller written? The ownership of the land, you know, belongs to the people, and nowhere was any title ever given by a god to the rich. And it was done in such a fashion that it was an ideal book for auto workers from the area that I came from to read. So we were primarily interested in going into all of this early socialist material, reading the American Guardian, and discussing just the most elementary ideas, and then the labor history of the Molly Maguires and the IWW and the all of the rest.
You were relatively removed from a lot of the factional fight in the beginning.
Yes.
Well, what happened?
Eugene Victor Debs was our number one god, and by this time, of course, he was dead. And then his inheritor, I suppose, in our eyes, was Norman Thomas in the early stages.
Now, by 34, say, when there was the fight over the Declaration of Principles, were you involved in that kind of debate, or was your group still very internal and primarily concerned with Flint?
Educating workers.
Mm-hmm.
No,
so
we were not involved.
It wasn't until you were defined as part of the Clarity group that there was a...
Any kind of internal participation at all.
Mm-hmm. Then... When the Clarity Group was formed, or when the factions became clear, was it just assumed, for instance, that your group was part of that faction because Michigan was, or was there actual debate and discussion and decisions around the alignment?
No, I think that the Clarity Group was formed about the same time that the Trotskyists entered the Socialist Party. I wasn't even aware of their entrance. You know, I don't believe I was then, and I certainly wasn't for some time after. During the strike, I didn't even know what the term... This is one aspect of revolutionary development I never knew existed, the whole struggle in the Soviet Union. I knew that the Soviet Union was attempting to build socialism under very difficult conditions, and it was still in a very barbaric state of socialism. But we were too busy trying to educate workers in this How could you make a revolution if you didn't talk to the people in your country, in your particular industry? So that I didn't even know that they had entered. I didn't know they had a paper. I didn't know all of this until after. And I believe the Clarity Group was formed on the basis of trying to have some kind of unity between the old guard. Yes, I went to a convention where Dubinsky and another very old guard, and they called him the old guard of the Socialist Party, and they had a debate, but again, I must have come back to Flint and completely forgotten about it. You know, put that out of my mind because I was so involved in educating the workers. I do remember there was David Dubinsky and another name of an old guard leader of the Socialist Party who left, and there was some kind of a debate at the National Convention.
In the 1936 convention, they left shortly after that.
Yeah.
The Social Democrat Federation or something like that.
Yes, yes. I was there at that convention.
At that point,
and there may have been another one from 1935, but again, it didn't seem to touch us. We felt that we were representing the workers in that party and not these intellectuals that were splitting hairs, you know. And really, this is the way. We were quite provincial. We were looking at it from that viewpoint. There were hair splitters and those bohemians from the East, you know. And we've got a job of getting people into the movement. That was the way we looked at it.
Well, how did you come to be defined as part of the Clarity faction?
Because the Clarity faction was had all the representatives of the union movement in it, the garment workers, socialists, and all the rest of them. And the Norman Thomas group, well, they had some of the others in it, too. I can't say that all of them were in the Clarity group. But the Norman Thomas group were primarily the writers, the intellectuals, and they're highly respected as far as Norman Thomas was highly respected, but he was not an organizer, and I sensed that. He didn't have any idea of organizing a party. He was the spokesman, and he was the writer. He was the educator. He was the teacher, but he was not an organizer, and he didn't want to get involved in any of the local situations that needed clarity.